So last week we looked at the Chatam Sofer, and this week we're looking at essentially a contemporary of his, the Nadav Yehuda, Rabbi Chezkel Landau, who was the Rav of Prague. If I'd thought properly when I threw together the order of Shiurim, then we would have just started off with the Nadav Yehuda. This is actually, he was born 50 years earlier than the Chatam Sofer, so he's 300. He was born 300 years ago, 1713. To put it in its historical context, important to note that he was a contemporary of the Vilna Gaon. That's important, not necessarily because of any particular relationship between the two, and I'm not aware of any particular relationship between the two. There may or may not have been. But of course, in its historical context, it puts it into the rise of Hasidism and the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim and that sort of those sort of concerns, predating the concerns that the Chatam Sofer was dealing with towards the second half of his life, which was the Haskalah and the Reform. So this is a very different set of concerns. The Haskalah was the beginning of the 19th century, so the latter part of the Chatam Sofer's lifetime, whereas the Nadav Yehuda was spared that, but had perhaps an even bigger tumult in the Jewish world, which was the rise of the Hasidic movement, and also dealing with the very famous dispute between Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Rabbi Yonatan Eibishitz, and also that, of course, was involved with the sort of the role of Kabbalah in Jewish life, etc. And one of the tshuvot we're going to see is related to that. As I said last week, and I assume I'll repeat it again for the next 8 weeks as well, is that the tshuvot that we see in the Nadav Yehuda reflect, the whole gamut of halakhic concerns, some of which are timely and some of which are timeless. And as I said last week, it's sort of always surprising, questions that presumably should have been resolved well before the Nadav Yehuda's time because they are timeless, still being discussed. For example, just one I looked at this afternoon was a question of a bar mitzvah boy. When does a boy become bar mitzvah or a girl become bat mitzvah? If they were born at 11 o'clock in the morning, do they not become bar mitzvah till 11 o'clock in the morning, or do they become bar mitzvah the night before? That's, it wasn't a new phenomena, having people who were born in the middle of the day in the times of the Nadav Yehuda, but it's a tshuva that finds expression in his work. Question of an onen, that's a person who's lost a relative and hasn't yet had the levaya, so he doesn't do any positive mitzvot. A question of Sfirat HaOmer for an onen. Does he, if remember, if he doesn't count Sfira that night, then he's going to lose the opportunity to count subsequent nights. So what's the din there? His conclusion is, just as an aside, his conclusion is that a mitzvah that doesn't take any time to do and doesn't interrupt with the aninut or the preparations for the avilut, so an onen is not exempted from. So it's a whole range of shelot and tshuvot that come up here. Further question that came up was with regard to Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin. Now there's two machlokets between Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi regarding Tefillin, or at least two machlokot. One with regard to the order of the parashiyot, and the other with regard to how the parashiyot are arranged in the tefillin, whether they're put upright, which is how we do them, or whether they're put horizontally, which is what Rabbeinu Tam says. So why, when we have Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, don't we put the parashiyot in horizontally? That's it should be an old question, but again addressed by the Nadav Yehuda. I've got some made a list of various questions that come up, and some we're going to go through. But again, like the Chatam Sofer, indispensable in terms of halachic psak, nothing which no major halachic shaila that one would be asked today would not be addressed at least peripherally in some way By the Noz Abi Huda. It's just, a strange phenomenon. This evening I was dealing with a shayla, and somebody asked me yesterday, I said, deal with it today. Question to do with the internet and Shabbat. Question to do with the person's thinking of buying, becoming a partner in a company, which the internet is owned by other Jews, and the internet site is up and running on Shabbat. And that's the issue, whether or not you can become a partner in that company. And the internet, the Nadav Yehuda had never heard of the internet. That matter, not Moshe Feinstein, but certainly the Nadav Yehuda had not heard of the internet. But an important dimension of that tshuva, which perhaps we'll discuss on another occasion, or the answer to that question, is dependent on a ruling of the Nadav Yehuda with regard to Schar Shabbat. So, even in the most current issues, the comments of the Noz Abi Huda are very, very important. Questions that come up, which we're not going to deal with properly, but just we've got, like the Chatam Sofer had last week, all these questions to do with Jewish status. Pages and pages to do, in Evin HaEzer, a lot to do with Heter Agunot. But also, these children being born out of wedlock. One of the questions I was going through this afternoon was a question of a woman who she's pregnant. She claims that it's not her husband isn't the father. The husband says he believes her. That's once he believes that his wife has been a zona, has prostituted herself, that makes her prohibited to him. She then changes her story and says, no, it wasn't, I never had znut with anybody else, I just wanted to try and get money out of somebody. And then she changes her mind again, and so now the husband says, I don't believe anything that she says, because she's, clearly a pathological liar, always changing her story. That's whether or not he's allowed to remain married to her, whether or not they can force her to accept a get, etc., etc. Those murky sort of stories, which we thought never happened in Dahaim, and we discovered last week, happened extensively. Question of a Kohen who's got a problem with his arms. Can't hold up his arms for the whole of Birkat Kohanim like that. So somebody came up with this wonderful suggestion. Why not attach some wires from his hat? Because who would duchen without their hat on, I suppose, attach some wires from his hat, and then they will support his hands, and he can put his thumbs through the wires, and that'll support his hands, and perhaps he can duchen like that. So that's, you could really, if his answer had been yes, which it wasn't, but if his answer had been yes, then, somebody could have made a fortune out of, marketing those sorts of Kohanisha hats just for duchening. That's okay. So those are sort of some of the questions. A very famous tshuva he's got with regard to hunting. That's is a Jew allowed to go on a hunting trip? Is there a problem of tsar? Not Abi Huda we're talking about. I'm just going to go through the shailas, and tonight whoever recognizes the shailas then says who it was. That's we should do that on a future occasion. But is it permitted to be a hunter? That's can you go hunting for sport? So his answer is, in terms of Tzar Bali Chaim, he thinks it's not such a big problem. But he says, look through Tanakh. Who were the hunters in Tanakh? That's Esav and Nimrod. So if those are your role models, then vakasha. But otherwise, one doesn't want to be a hunter. In any event, that's sort of the fun background. And I think there should be just about enough for one each. Maybe one or two people will need to share. What I wanted to go through a number of tshuvot in the next 45 minutes, some of which or which reflect different responses to considerations in modernity. So I want to start off with the first question, which is of great interest to us when we're fixing the times for services. And every now and then it comes up a suggestion that maybe we should daven later on a Shabbat morning, so that some of the people who walk in at 9:45 will get a nasty surprise when they find that we're only up to Baruch Shamar or something like that. So the question is, Masha Sha'al, Eze Adif Bimei HaKayetz? So in the summer, well, of course, in the summer, Sof Zman Kriyat Shema is relatively early. So you need to start davening fairly early. Im lehitacher b'kriya levetak kneset, should we have a late starting time for shul? Kedei sheyuchlu hazakenim gam kein lavor. It's a bit ageist, this, but it's saying so that the old people can also come to shul. Af shem shahim ad achar zman kriyat shema. Even though shul is going to be after Sof Zman Kriyat Shema. Sof Zman Kriyat Shema is whatever time. So start tefillah late, and that way more people will be able to get to shul and have tefillah betzibur. Of course, what he's going to deal with here is two different constituencies and two different concerns. On the one hand, we want to say Kriyat Shema with its brachot at the right time. On the other hand, we want to include as many people as possible in tefillah betzibur. So which one's going to be the overriding consideration? As an aside, it's kind of interesting. We just don't worry about that. You know, we daven at 9:15 the whole year round, and the Gabbai will announce on Friday night, Sof Zman Kriyat Shema is at whatever time, and hopefully people will remember to say Shema before they come to shul on the Shabbat morning. It's kind of interesting that, you know, we don't even ask the question about that. In any event, or adif lahashkim bismano, is it better to get up early? V'yudchu azakenim legamrei, and the older members of the community, tough on them. Likro lipalel biyachid, they're going to have to just daven at home because they're not going to be able to get to shul in time. Anitama. So, his starting point is, what sort of question is this? V'chi omrim la'adam chatei sheyizke chaveirecha. This is a Talmudic principle that we don't say to a person, well, you should sacrifice your own religious integrity in order to enable somebody else to to do a mitzvah. Now, the parameters of this are very interesting, and certainly in a communal context, certainly in an outreach context, you know, these are important questions that need to be asked. And this response of the Nota Bihuda will be a relevant consideration in trying to formulate an answer. But, you know, for example, if a person's going to be a madrich on a Shabbaton or something like that, or lead a Shabbaton, or have an outreach service, a beginner's service or something like that, where there's no possibility to, it's fine if you live in northwest London, you can go to a Hashkama and then go on and take a beginner's service in a shul and miss davening a bit sibyl yourself. But if you're in a place where, you know, I know when I was the rabbi in Belmont, so a couple of times a year we'd have an explanatory service running parallel to the main tefillah. And there the question was, you know, there was no possibility of going to both. So it was, you know, is one entitled to miss tefillah betzibur in order to, create an educational opportunity, for others? And, you know, often people say, chinuch, everything's mutter. But, you know, chinuch, not everything is mutter. And it's, you know, one of the challenges is working out sort of, you know, what should one sacrifice one's own religious aspirations in order to bring others closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this tshuva will be a relevant factor in that equation. Because the person who gets up early and comes to shul and is able to say Kriyat Shema uvirchotei in the right time, that's praiseworthy. Umitacher posheahu, and a person who delays is a posheah, is a transgressor. So he's not happy with it at all. And he says, Umasherati to l'damotzi. He says, hold on a minute. We do this all the time. All year round, we daven Maariv before it gets dark. Certainly in the summer we do, and even in the winter. Sunday afternoons on the in the winter, we have Mincha followed by Maariv, davening Maariv before it gets dark. The only reason we're allowed to do that is because it's Tirchat Tzibura, to get everybody to come back 20 minutes later, or to come back on a Friday night for Tefillah at 10:30. It's going to be Tirchat Tzibura, it's not going to work. Alma Shemak Dimin Kriyat Shema Lifnei Zmano. So we see we often say Kriyat Shema not in the optimal time. Kedei Likrot Ulit Palel B'Tzibur, because our major concern is Tefillah B'Tzibur. So his answer is as follows: B'Mechila Ein Dimyono Ola Yafe. I don't think it's a good comparison. Ba'arvich Yesh Lanu Al Malishma Charbe Poskim Shosom Chama Rabbi Yehuda. Maariv is different to Shachrit. At Maariv, there are many Rishonim who hold that the halakha is like Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says you can daven Maariv from Plag HaMincha onwards, and that's how we paskin. But many poskim hold that according to Rabbi Yehuda, you can even say Shema from Plag HaMincha onwards. That you don't need to say Shema after dark, that you can say Shema earlier. Now, we don't paskin like that in a practical sense, and we always say you should repeat Shema afterwards as well. But at least there is such a view that we can rely on in terms of the bracha. Was man arvit hacha plag hamincha, and Maariv time is after plag hamincha. So he's rejecting that, and he's squarely against davening later on a Shabbat, so that the older people will be able to come to shul. I would add to this also the consideration that he's talking the difference between Maariv and Shachrit. Is Shachrit seems from the question that actually they were originally davening early and they want to change the system to daven later. But that would be a horadah in kedusha. That wouldn't be, you've got an optimum system, but, position, and you would be then turning into moving towards a non-optimum situation. So that would be another reason to say no. But again, it's kind of interesting that that we don't bat an eyelid at it. All the shuls in Northwest, and lots of shuls have early minyanim as well. It's standard practice in Frum shuls in Northwest London, including our own Kila Kadosha. Daven at 9:15, and it's after Sosma and Kriyat Shema, and we rely on the fact that everybody says Shema beforehand. As an aside, it's interesting just to note that in 1892 there was a whole series of proposed reforms presented to Chief Rabbi Adler from a number of shuls in London. They wanted all sorts of changes to the Seder HaTefillah. One of which was moving start of Shabbat morning services to a later time. Services always started at 8 o'clock on Shabbat morning, and they wanted to move it to a 9 o'clock start, 9:30 start, something like that. Chief Rabbi Adler was very, very reluctant about allowing that, and he says in the protocols of the conference, he says that if it's really absolutely necessary, then it can be done. But care has to be taken to make sure that everybody says the three paragraphs of Shema before davening. That's it's and somehow we've moved on as a community like that. We sort of goes on the newsletter, Sossaman Kriyat Shema, but people don't sort of seem to worry, even though of course it's a din and everybody should observe it. But it's kind of interesting how even in Anglican Anglo-Jewry of the late 19th century, which is was Anglo-Jewish, it's most Anglican. Chief Rabbi Adler was very concerned not to miss Sossaman Kriyat Shema in shul.
I wonder if something you had mentioned before, perhaps the many one could say the many Yehudas happening in a city, there was only one shul, so that's why he was very, very concerned, because these people will be forced to daven later than they want to.
Well, he's clearly talking about a situation where there's only going to be one, because that would be our obvious solution. In a contemporary context, would be to say, "Oh, okay, so fine. They want to have a later minyan. I mean, because that would definitely be better. Because he's saying the zakenim have to daven by themselves. So presumably, it would definitely be better for them to daven tefillah b'tzibur." Rather, later, so you could have a late, a retiree's minion. I mean, it looks like it's. I mean, it might be that it's a shul city, one big shul, and they just have one tefillah. That's presumably that's correct. Sorry? He was in Prague. Interestingly, though, we'll see, you know, he got his Shalot and Chuvot from all over the place, including one Shuva that we'll look at this evening, one that I found this afternoon. I meant to do a Bar Ilan search on this. He had questions coming to him from London. One of the questions that he had from London was about a Kohen who'd gone off to India, married an Indian girl in a Hindu ceremony in a temple, where he'd had to bow down to the priest and swear by the Hindu god. And then he became a Baal Teshuva, and he divorced his Indian wife and wanted to duchen again. And I don't know which shul it was in London. Well, there weren't many shuls in London at that time. I don't know if it was Bevis Marks or Duke's Place. But in any event, the question came to the Lord of Behuda about whether or not he was allowed to duchen. And we'll come to another question, very important, Shaila also from London. So he was his influence stretched far and wide. Let's look at number two. Pesach Dick sugar production. So this question actually came from Berlin. I've taken out a couple of lines here, you can see at the beginning, because it's a whole spiel about, there was some family wedding in Berlin, and he's wishing everybody Mazel Tov, and he was sorry he wasn't able to be there, but his brother was there, and somebody's brother was there. And the Shaila came to him from Berlin about the Pesach Dick sugar. And again, you know, the Pesach Dick sugar, I mean, these are questions that come up all the time. So the question was, they have this Pesach Dick sugar in Berlin. So he says, I understand that you are machmir, you'll only use, it seems they were making some sort of sugar solution that they were using, and he's using your machmir only to use the powder, the sugar powder, which comes in a box. So it seems like some came in crates, and some sugar arrived in Berlin in barrels. And for some reason, the Rav there was worried about the kashrut of the sugar that came in the barrels, and he wasn't worried about the kashrut of the sugar that came in the boxes. V'shalmi meni halach l'maisa. You want to know what we should do. V'omnam chashli l'horot b'mkomos. Really, it's not for me to get involved in this discussion. V'im ha'davah ha'yotzei mimenu l'chalutin l'isor. If you would definitely say it was osa, lo ha'iti kotev b'davah zeh klav. Then this is good rabbinic etiquette. Say, if you, as the Marad Archer, have said it's osa, then I wouldn't get involved in the question. But actually, you seem to be just machmir about it. So therefore, I'm entitled to, seeing as I've been asked, I'm entitled to give a response. Avalafidar at Varav Shel Hakatsin Hanal Gammal Atolo Heklit Atolo Chalutim. It seems that you're not 100% sure that it's Asa, so I can say something. Vani Lichora Lo Uchal Leidamakom Luchum Razu. So I don't know why you're being so frum about things. Be'emet mitchila ha'yiti tamali karei ha'heta shel atzuka. It's true. I have to tell you, when I first heard about the issues with sugar, so I also wasn't so sure about things. Ke'avon sha'apudar hazeh kvanit bashel sham bimkomo. Because when you get it, it's already been processed in some way. It's processed in a non-Jewish factory. And there's no heksher on the packet. Who knows how it's made? Maybe it's got chametz mixed in with it. Seeing as they've been using this sugar for Pesach for donkey's years, even before they had this hot sukkah, which I think is this sugar solution, we can assume that earlier generations went into it. So this is, in its own right, an interesting halachic methodology. Yeah, he's got a bit of a shaila about something being Pesach Dick, They've been using it for many years. So he's working on the assumption that whatever was the Rav at the time had looked into it and made sure that it was kasher to Pesach, and that the process had been checked. Now, I assume that he's working on the assumption that the rabbinate there in Berlin was a good, reliable rabbinate. We're not talking about in some, where were you for the weekend? Wexford in Ireland. So, you know, if you find three leprechaun Jews in Wexford in Ireland who are using the local beer on Pesach, so you don't necessarily need it. The fact that they've been doing it for years doesn't necessarily mean to say that they had good rabbinical authority. But it is a well-established halachic methodology that you assume that other people have looked into certain situations and you can rely on their findings. The Gamata B'choref HaAvar HaYabikiz HaTeinu Meshulach Meretz Yisrael. It says last winter there was somebody who came from Eretz Yisrael. V'u bar avan bar uryan v'yirei Hashem me'rabim. And he's good from Jews, learned a lot of Torah. V'hu siper li sheba mitzrayim gedelim hakanim halalu. Explain to me that in Egypt they grow sugar cane. That's, they weren't so familiar with, in the time of the Not Abi Huda, they weren't so familiar with sugar. There's a famous story about Rabbi Akiva Eger. We're going to be looking at Rabbi Akiva Eger next week. Rabbi Akiva Eger, who was a contemporary of the Not Abi Huda, when the Rabbi Akiva Eger took up one of his positions as Rav, and they brought him round some tea and sugar, whatever. He had never seen a sugar cube before. He had no idea what to do with it. That's processed sugar was. Is in that part of Europe wasn't so prevalent, it seems. Sham gamkein osin hapuza ve'ein bo shum chashash chimutz. So he's saying there's no worry about chametz at all. Now comes the interesting halachic considerations. V'imkein mali haba b'teva or b'chaviot. So who cares whether it comes in a case or it comes in a barrel? V'im choshish liziyufa. Now, if you're worried about perhaps they're mixing in some flour because perhaps the flour is cheaper than the sugar, so if you add in, say, 5% flour, that'll save on your costs. M'shashelokim min hateva, menichim shebachat b'chaviot. When they transfer it from the boxes into the barrels, milvad shechashash ziyuf bazehu chashash rachok. There's a number one, I don't think it's unlikely to happen. It's not just a problem in terms of it not being Pesach dik, but also the goyim there will be concerned about it. There'll be trading standards officers who won't stand for it. Sheyurav bo kemach. That's either trading standards officers, or it might just be the consumers, that every time you want to put a spoon of sugar in your tea, and you find out that it's, why has it got all sorts of gunji? Because it's got flour mixed in it. Certainly the big sugar manufacturers don't do this. This is an halachic principle that professionals aren't going to jeopardize their professional standards by selling inferior goods. So therefore, if it's being sold as 100% sugar, so then you can believe that it's 100% sugar. And this is a halakhic consideration. All sorts of things, on the Bet Din list. The Bet Din list. There's no hashkacha on these things. But it's it goes on to talk about the notion of nochri mesiach lefitumor, that you have a Gentile manufacturer. You're asking a question, he's giving you an answer. They've got no reason not to tell the truth, and we can assume they don't want to harm their own the professional quality of what they're producing. So if you've got a firm that is tells you everything is animal fats, they don't use any everything is vegetable fats, they don't use any animal fats. Certainly nowadays, with the vegetarian market and everything, if it was turned out that it was the wrong thing, that's, so then they would lose consumer confidence. If they say, you guarantee that it's 100% vegetable fat, then you can assume this is 100% vegetable fats. Yeah.
what happened with the Horsebeat scandal? Does that cause any problems politically for us now? Because what you're saying.
So there was a lot of discussion about that at the time, and the halakhic times were actually the opposite. Once it was discovered that it was horse meat, then consumer confidence plummeted. So if anything, it made the kosher put the kosher consumer into a stronger position rather than a weaker position.
Then you have Marmite, which supposedly 100% vegetarian, with other
Fine, I don't know the ins and the outs, except for the fact that now you can't even get South African Marmite, and that's a major concern. Okay. Question gets asked all the time is, can I go into Starbucks and have a coffee in Starbucks, or it's not so much just Starbucks, but a person's having business meeting somewhere, can you have a coffee there, that's in a hotel or whatever it is, people going out on a date, can they go to a regular hotel and sit in the lobby and have a cup of coffee? Now, one of the key questions will be here is, what's the kashrut of the cups there? Now, the cups, problem might well be that they've been washed up with everything else that goes through the dishwasher or the sink or whatever. And it's true that a cup of coffee, what's in the cup of coffee? Coffee and water and milk, if you take it with milk. But the coffee itself won't be a problem, but you've now got a problem, perhaps, with the cup being washed up with everything else. So a person, anybody who's learned Yoredeya, will say, hold on, Stam Kini Meinam B'nei Yoman, that we have a principle that certainly as far as non-Jewish Kelim are concerned, we assume that Stam Kini Meinam B'nei Yoman, they weren't used in the past 24 hours. If a Keli wasn't used in the past 24 hours, so then it's not Ein Tam Lifgam, the taste there is an inferior taste, and that's a further consideration for us to be, or that's a factor which, combined sometimes with other factors, will allow us to be lenient. Now, that might be true if I go into my next door neighbour's house and to take them a parcel that's been delivered to me. And they say, would you like a cup of tea? And I want to be a nice neighbour, so I say, fine, I'll have a cup of tea. And they pull out a mug and I gently wipe off the cobwebs from it, and I understand Stam Keli Meinam B'nei Yoman, and it hasn't been used in the past 24 hours. You go into an establishment which is dedicated to selling food, so then perhaps the situation is going to be different. They're using everything several times every day. So do we simply apply the principle Stam Keli Meinam B'nei Yoman, even if we think that that's unlikely to be true? Or is it Stam Keli Meinam B'nei Yoman, but these aren't Stam Kelim? And this is a question which the Nozav Yehuda addresses. And this is Al-Dvar Coffee Shalan. So these seems to be coffee cups. Shel Einam Yehudim, but coffee heiser shela. In the coffee houses. This, I think, also came from Berlin. Yafer Horele Isso. That's... you're right to say that you can't do it. She'ein kan shum safek. There's no safek about the status of the cups. Ubevatai hein b'nei yoman. You can't say they weren't used within 24 hours. Of course they were used in the past 24 hours. She'bechol sha'a shotim mehen chalav she'ein o Yehudi. Because the whole time they're drinking non-supervised milk out of these cups. That's the whole fact. We can say, okay, it's a klisheni, it's not b'nei yoman. So firstly, it is b'nei yoman. And secondly, you want to say it's a klisheni, it's not, you haven't boiled up the coffee in the cup. That's not l'chatchila. The heter of klisheni is not going to be l'chatchila. V'ataz v'rashal machmirim b'klisheni. The Taz and the Rashal are strict about klisheni. V'ashach katav al kol panim b'klicheres l'hachmir. As far as the shach is concerned, so certainly with pottery or earthenware, one needs to be machmir in a klisheni l'chatchila. So Sam to wander into the coffee shop is going to be a big problem, because it's the heter of klisheni is not lechatchila, and we haven't got the heter of stam kelim ebnei yoman. Umashiv lo sheshiv shehishiv lo hameshiv sheba Prague shotim bnei Torah bavatim shelein or yudi. So the fact that I went to Prague and I saw a man with a strimal sitting in a coffee shop drinking a cup of coffee. Yadarum malato imhem bnei Torah. Einam b'nei yira. He might be a big Talmid Chacham who's sitting in the coffee shop, but he's got no yirat shamayim. That's v'hema kaleidat. These are feeble-minded people who do such things. Ula halacha l'maase. So let's get down to bottom line. B'derech b'ushpiza. If you're on a journey, you're travelling, and you're in a hotel somewhere, shein sham kelim achirim, and you can't get a disposable cup, they've run out of polystyrene cups. So mechshav diavad, and that's regarded as b'diavad. That's regarded as b'diavad. We said we'll allow kli sheini, so it would be all right. But lechatchila don't want to do it. Aval be'ir. In the city, b'makom sheish klei yehudim, where you can go into Orleans or wherever you like. V'aday asor ve'im ma'arem kli rishon afilu diavad asor. If it's being poured from a non-kosher kli rishon, then you still got a problem. V'kvar dibarti mizepo. I've dealt with it here. That's v'heshiv harav hamau agadol. Moreno Rav Meir Fishlish Shulai Makilin Hovel or Shchia Chalav Tamei Uchadat HaPri Chadash. Says, maybe why is it that they're being makel in Prague about things? Might be because they're holding that the milk isn't a problem. In these coffee houses, the only issue actually was the milk. They weren't serving any treif, it seems, in the coffee house. The problem was the milk. The milk wasn't Chalav Yisrael. And the Nodav Yehuda, as do many poskim, hold that Chalav Yisrael wasn't just a chumrah, but Chalav Yisrael was a necessity. And it's if it was Chalav Akum, then it traced up the kelim. So it says maybe in Prague those people were following the view of the Pri Chadash. Pri Chadash, very famous shita. The Pri Chadash was the Rav in Amsterdam. And he held that, or certainly they followed this view in Amsterdam. I'm not certain if he was the Rav in Amsterdam at the time, but certainly he held that if there's no tame animals around which get milked, then you don't need to worry about chalav akum, and you can have regular milk. That's one of the reasons why many people here are makel on regular milk. And just as a historical aside, the minhag in Amsterdam always till very recently was not to have Chalav Yisrael, based on the ruling of the Pri Chadash. The first community here in post-restoration England was Jews from Holland. And I think that might have something to do with why till the 1920s, I think Chalav Yisrael had been pretty much unheard of here in England as well. I think that was the minhag. It was just following the minhag of Amsterdam. It was the minhag hamakom. That's he says in the last paragraph. The frum people don't drink coffee in goyish establishments. And even the balabatim, even if they're not Talmidei Chachamim, but they've been to a few shiurim, they also don't drink in the coffee shops. The last line is interesting. Now, to put a notice on Facebook and tell everybody they mustn't do it, that's a new Facebook group, Don't Drink in Starbucks, that's, we can't do that. Because they just won't understand. They see some people who are not so from doing it, and they think everybody can do it. As an aside, about anybody here on the KLBD Kosher Updates Facebook feeds? Yeah, a few people are. So every couple of weeks, somebody asks the question about what's the din about having coffee in a Starbucks or non-kosher establishment. And they always post back. Michal Emanuel comes on and posts back to the old KLBD post, which is an interesting lashon, but it's directly reflecting this tshuva of the Nodav Yehuda. It says something along the lines of that it's not, if kosher establishments are available, then it's not recommended to, or it's, I forget if it's not recommended or it is recommended only to drink from there. It's not recommended to have from Starbucks. But if there's no kosher establishments available, then it's acceptable to have plain coffee or tea in non-kosher, but it's preferable to have a polystyrene disposable cup, right? Reflecting exactly these considerations. That's the big issue in Starbucks is what the stuff is all mixed together with. How it's washed up. That's and whether it's washed up together with the whether they serve food in the Starbucks. I've never been into a Starbucks, so I'm not sure what goes on in Starbucks. But yes,
that's.
I lie. You're right. I once in New York. I once went in for an orange juice to use the Wi-Fi. That was it. Anyhow. So it depends. If they're serving tray food and then everything gets washed up together, so then you've got a problem. But if they're not, then it's less of a problem. The CRC, Chicago Rabbinical Council, a couple of years ago, put out a whole paper on Hilchot Starbucks and under what circumstances you can have, what circumstances you can't have. So it's a little bit different here rather than in America, but it certainly makes good reading. In any event, this Juva Yoradea Simon Lamed Vav, is mamash, Maisim Shebachol Yom, the question about having coffee in those sorts of establishments. Let's touch on a few more. I want to touch on three more tshuvot. Won't go through all of them inside. As I said, the historical background to the Nodah Bihuda was that Hasidic movement was in its infancy. A lot of opposition from the Vilna Gaon and his Talmidim. And one of the things that was gaining currency was Kabbalistic meditations prior to doing mitzvot. As you open a siddur, open any self-respecting siddur nowadays, Sirat HaOmer, and it will have a lengthy Kabbalistic meditation, and for various other mitzvot as well. He deals with this in fairly caustic terms. Fal haravit asher shal benusach l'shem yichud. So you've asked me a question about what's the correct nusach for this L'shem Yichud, which is said before doing mitzvot. Asher chadashim mikarov, nitpashet v'nitfas besidurim. A newfangled practice is to print it in the sidurim. Hinei bazeh ani meshiv. I'll tell you what my answer is. Ad she'ata sho'aleini nusach amirato. Don't ask me whether it should be exactly what the nusach should be. Yoter ra'u l'shol im nomar. Kitzov b'amirat, or ask me whether I think you should say it at all. That, and then we'll talk about the nusach. Uladati zera'a chola b'dorenu. This is a great malady in our generation to start trying to introduce such things. That's previous generations, they'd never heard, I can promise you. He said, Rashi and the Rambam never said these sorts of hinanis and l'shem yichuds. Their whole lives they were immersed in Torah and mitzvot. They never said such things. Hakol al pi haTorah v'al pi haPoskim. They were good, frum, learned Jews who knew lots of Torah. They are totally immersed in Shas. You can't get frummer than them. They never said such things. He goes on to say, now all of a sudden we're introducing these newfangled things. We really don't need them. Don't need them at all. And he goes on to say, I think that if you've got any mitzvah which has a bracha, then the bracha is good enough. Benching lulav, sheg shana b'svatav tishvano al netilat lulav. That's all you need to say. You don't need to say anything else at all. That's, you're putting on your talit, netar tefpat tzitzit. That's good enough. You don't need any of these l'shem yichuds. That he says, you know what, if it's something which doesn't have a bracha beforehand, so in the just towards the end of the middle paragraph, chol davar she'en bracha lefaneh, if there's no bracha before it, ani noheg lomar b'fi, so I say, hinni oseh davar zeh l'kei mitzvat bori, I'm doing this for the sake of the mitzvah, uvazeh dai vein sarach yoteh, so I'm doing hashavat aveidah, I'm giving you back your, I found your iPhone somewhere, and that's good enough. You don't need to spend 10 minutes before you give the person back his iPhone saying a lengthy hinani or something of that nature. And before you do a mitzvah, you know, cut out all this. I'm using the term cautiously and excessively, but almost what he's saying, cut out the mumbo jumbo. Now. You know, that's what he's saying. Obviously, different traditions evolved. It's interesting that the Anglo-Jewish tradition was very much not to recite any of these hinanis. If you look in the classic old Sidurim of Anglo-Jewry, they didn't have hinanis. There's one exception. The one exception is before the Tilat Lulav. There's some story, I think it's based on a Rabbi Yaakov Emden, that he was very keen on saying that, and for some reason that was included in the in the machzah. If you look in the Routledge machzah for Sukkot, it has that hinani. But for Sfirat HaOmer, which, you know, everybody says hinani before Sfirat HaOmer, that's not part of the traditional Anglo-Jewish nusach there.
Okay.
He was born 300 years ago.
He was around
300 years ago. He was a contemporary of the Vilna Gaon, which makes him a contemporary of the Baal Shem Tov as well. That's Rabbi Radal is a Chabadnik. So I say contemporary of the Vilna Gaon, you say contemporary of the Baal Shem Tov. But we're all on the same side. That's exactly what he was reacting to. Yeah. Reb Yaakov Emden was in, certainly his son, the Chacham Tzvi was, his father, the Chacham Tzvi was. The Chacham Tzvi was also here in London. That's for a brief period at Bevis Marks. Whether or not that has a bearing on the... Yeah, from Amsterdam, yeah. But that would have been more in the Sfard, from the Sfardi shuls, in terms of, you know, what they were doing at Duke's Place. In the Hamra, I'm not sure they would have based it on the Minhagim of the Sfardim. Correct.
So can you just relate that for a moment to the whole controversy or whatever about changing the format of prayer service and making additions to prayer service?
Okay, that's an interesting question. So certainly the hinani that the Baal Musaf says is also not in all. Again, it's become one of those things. Avi and I had a little bit of a Facebook discussion about this a couple of weeks ago. That's not everybody, you know, nowadays you'd be regarded as not very frum shul if the chazan didn't say that hinane. It's not in the Routledge Machsa, because that wasn't the minhag in Hamburg. I think that's following the view of the Vilna Gaon, not to say, the chazan shouldn't say that hinane. In terms of this was one of the tainas against, you know, which the Mitnagdim had against the Chassidim, that they were changing nusach, changing minhag. The whole question of changing nusach and minhag in tefillah, there are two essentially two schools. One is that you can't change anything, and everything has to be done exactly the way it was always done. And you can't, you know, if you say, if you're a person who's always said, mikol tov lo'olam al yechasareinu, so to take out the lo'olam is changing your minhag, you know, your minhag is to say lo'olam. Others say, and this is certainly that can't be true because there are always subtle changes that that creep in. But some people want to suggest that's true. Rav Moshe Feinstein says that changes. We're looking at big things. That's not really a change in the nusach. Change in the nusach is shifting from davening nusach Ashkenaz to davening Teimani. Right? That's a change in nusach. Yeah, but that's even if you change from nusach Ashkenaz to nusach Sfard, he thought it wasn't such a big shift in change of minhag.
Like, let's say, taking out some book on the shuffle, leaving it in, changing the minhag.
Because you know what? That's such a big topic. I don't want to, we've got less than 10 minutes. I just want to finish off a couple more things from the Nadab Yehuda. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it, definitely. Very important shuvah of the Nadab Yehuda with regard to autopsies. This comes from London. That's you can see at the end of the first line. Sheila Shebaalayev Mikufkuf London. Person had some. It seems like he had a kidney stone, and they took it out, but the poor fellow died. And what they wanted to do was they wanted to conduct a PM. So they could see what they'd done, where they'd gone wrong, what was causing the problem, and to see if next time around in the future they'd have a better understanding of kidney stones and how to deal with them. So he goes through in the first paragraph. He brings Vahamatir, those who say that it's permissible. They base themselves on the fact that Yaakov Avinu and Yosef HaTzadik, they were embalmed. So that would indicate that you can perhaps do things to corpses. In the second paragraph, he brings the Osrim, Gemara in Bava Kama, which talks about in Bnei Brak, where Rabbi Akiva was emphatic that you're not allowed to be a menafel, the mate, and that you can't do anything to the deceased body. And he goes on to say that according to that, even if the family give permission, it's not their body to give permission to. Anyhow, he goes on to discuss the question of maybe this is Hatzalat Nefashot. And for Hatzalat Nefashot, we allow lots of things. Pretty much everything except for the three cardinal sins. So if that's the case, it should be permitted. He's got an interesting conclusion, though, at the end. If you look, I suppose about halfway down to the last words on the line, it says Aval. Aval anitama halor imze yikra afilu safe katzalat nefashot. So I'm not really sure that conducting a PM is really regarded as even a safek hatzalat nefashot. Why not? Because he says that we're not talking about a case where you've got another person suffering from the same problem in the next bed in the hospital, and you want to work out, what's going on here. You could have a person, a person dies of Ebola. Right, so you know what? That's unfortunately, Ebola's a massive plague at the moment. So you want to do a post mortem because you've got 100 patients in the next ward who've got the same problem. Let's see how we can treat this. Then of course that's Hatzalat Nefashot. But a case where it's just advancing medical knowledge says that's not really Hatzalat Nefashot, and it won't allow us to have Nivul Hamait, which raises all sorts of all sorts of questions, in terms of long-term views, short-term views, but certainly that's the ruling of the Nadab Yehuda, and any serious discussion of post-mortems takes very serious consideration of what the Nadab Yehuda says. Other poskim are a little bit more lenient if the deceased himself said that they allow their body to be given to medical science, but certainly not something to do without consulting a competent Orthodox rabbi. But the general approach is in line with those comments of the Not Abbi Huda. Finish off just with a question that he deals with. That's regarding the burial of stillborns. It's a follow-up tshuva to a question of whether or not you can bury a stillborn on Yom Tov. And he goes on to discuss the whole question of whether or not it's even necessary to bury a stillborn. This is a question that comes up from time to time. I've got involvement as rabbinic advisor to the Burial Society. And you might recall a couple of years ago, there was a whole expose in the JC about fetuses 50 years ago hadn't been buried, or did they need to be buried? Were they being buried, etc., etc.? And it's a question that a couple of times a year comes up. Get a phone call, and there's been a stillborn. Parents want to know, a late miscarriage or a midterm miscarriage, whatever. You know, is there a necessity to bury the, or what stage is there a chiyuv of kavura? So the chiddush of the Not Abbi Huda is that in actual fact there's no requirement of kavura at all. He says, what's the purpose of kavura? He says, the purpose of kavura is so there shouldn't be bizayon hamet. It shouldn't be, there shouldn't be, it's a function of kavod hamet, essentially. It says that stillborn, the concern of kavod hamet in the regular sense doesn't exist. That's not to say that the fetus can be destroyed in a cavalier manner, but the chiyuv of kavura as a religious obligation doesn't exist. Our general practice is that any fetus that has reached the stage where it could be a viable fetus, we bury. So any fetus over, I think, 21 weeks, we bury. But under that, so we also bury if the family want that. That's
you bury it on their own or together with another?
Uniting will buries by itself. That gives it its own independent space. Some Chevron Kadishas, bury it with other people. But in any event, he's saying min adin, it's not saying that it's osa to bury a fetus, and it's a very sensitive issue. And that's why I say, you know, it's not the regular form of kavod which is required. You know, sometimes it'll come up that, perhaps... you know, there's a concern of infection or something like that, or for whatever reason, it's difficult to access the fetus, and, you know, then is the hospital allowed to, take care of it in the normal manner, and, you know, the considerations of Not Abbi Huda are important considerations.
The